All right, we might get started. My name's Aaron Catter, and I've been lucky enough to chair the session that Scott Reeves and Julie Yang are going to present to us. Just by way of introduction, Scott's is the underwriting manager at Casualty for Munich Re. Says here covers both treaty and facultative for the Australia and New Zealand markets. There's a bunch of other stuff written about Scott, but I'll just move quickly on to Julia, who's also co-presenting. Julia Yang is a casualty underwriter also of Munich Re Australia and focuses on treaty business in the Australasian market. We're going to hear about a 25-minute presentation by Scott and Julia on observations on European motor bodily injury insurance. Please, we encourage any questions afterwards, and Scott specifically asked for some feedback to be given on the level of detail that is going to be delved into in this particular presentation, potentially influencing future work. So take it away, Scott.
Thanks, Aaron. Let me set some context here. Thinking about the seminar, it occurred to me that in Australia we have enormous knowledge worldwide about some schemes that might be of interest to delegates at this seminar. So what we did was contact our friends in Munich and say, surely you've done some presentations in the past, what can we have? Now that's been a blessing, but I also should point out that it doesn't imply that Julia and myself now have an in-depth knowledge of European schemes. So whilst we're going to talk about motor bodily injury and some perspectives on that, can I point out that if anybody in this room has ever been to Europe, it's a fair to middling chance you know more about the schemes than we do. Feel free at the end to ask any questions you have, but as Aaron said, we were trying to work out the level to pitch this. We've deliberately chosen a very high-level overview of some schemes to highlight some interesting things. Please, on your feedback forms, do communicate back to us about whether you think it's pitched at the right level or whether you might, in future, want to see it drilled down to, say, one scheme in particular, get a more depth of understanding. And also, if you have any questions that at the end we can't answer, and it is possible, I'm more than happy to take them on notice and see if we can come back to you by tapping into the people we have. The talk today is going to cover these three elements. Julia will cover the first two, and then I'll step in to cover the third. So, Julia, over to you.
Thank you, Scott. Yes. I'm going to talk about these large motor bodily injury claims which we have seen in European market, and later on we will highlight some compensation scheme for different European countries. Okay, when we talk about the large motor bodily injury event has happened in Europe, and the first thing I think about is the Sylvie rail crash, which happened in 2001. That one happened because of a Range Rover with a trailer who crashed with a high-speed rail train in 2001, and eventually has 10 people dead and 94 people injured. The estimated bodily injury amount is $28 million. A similar case has happened 10 years later in 2011. So it is a TGV collision in France, a similar scenarios. So the injured person's less, only half, 48 person injured and two dead. And the bodily injury loss amount is quite similar compared to 10 years ago. So what has happened? So hopefully after this session, you can find the answer. Either it's a different scheme between UK or France, or there's some risk of change has happened during these 10 years. Another group of motor vehicle accident is the tunnel. So in 1999, actually just within 3 months, there was two big motor losses. One happened in Austria, another in France. So both cases are quite similar. Actually, it's a big fire caused by a truck. So eventually people who just had their car in the tunnel can hardly escape from the big fire. So a lot of cars has been burned, and it takes around 50 hours for the firefighters to control the fire, and eventually there's around 42 people in there's 12 dead, and another case is like 39 people dead. So the amount of the bodily injury is around 28 million and another one is 30 million. The last one, actually, we can hardly recognize that case to any group because it's so unique. And from our research, that's its largest loss has ever bodily injury loss has ever happened in Europe. So it happens in 1978. So there was a very popular camping site just near the beach in Spain. At that day, it's a weekend, so it's more than 1,000 people who just camp at the beach. So there was an explosion that took place near that camping site when a leaking tank truck loaded with 23 tons of highly flammable liquid just ignited. So the result is a massive explosion and fireball that reached over 500 degrees centigrade and destroyed everything within the 300 meter radius. So more than 140 people were killed immediately and more than 500 people were injured. So the estimated number for that specific event is around 140 million. So that's really very sad case happening in Europe. Here we just give you a very brief summary of what the observation we have and what the bodily injury case has happened in Europe. So we listed the last column is the bodily injury components, and the second one on the right hand side is the loss amount, which including the property damage. You can see this different. Because in Europe there's so many different countries, so after have seen all these losses in the European country, then we come up a question: what's the difference between different European countries if the same event happened? Are they quite different compared to country to country? Is that same in France or in Austria or in Germany? So the second part of this presentation, we talk about the multiple injury compensation scheme in some selected countries because, you know, we have so many countries in Europe, so we just cover some or highlight some of them. When we talk about the bodily injury scheme, so the basic question we can ask ourselves is what's the basic models for the severe injury, because it could be so different from country to country. We identify these two basic models. The first one is the insurance company bear all the cost or risk. So which means the social insurer may pay first, but later on they will request they will ask the motor third party liability insurer to pay back. The second one is there's some state involvement, so which means the social insurer will step up to cover these bodily injury for the severe the bodily injury case for the severe injured person. So which means from the motor third party insurance perspective, actually in their motor portfolio these severe costs will not be paid by them. The implication of these two models, the first one is there's no subrogation from the social system. The second one is there may be some national bodily injury scheme in Europe, in some of European countries. The second one, actually, most of them is from the Nordic country, means Finland, Sweden, Norway, and even Netherlands. And the rest of the European country, they apply the first model, so which means the insurance company has to bear all the cost. In this chart, we try to group or identify the payment methods they apply in Europe. So on the right-hand side is the mainly lump sum payment. So you can see the extreme cases for Denmark and Norway. So it's purely lump sum payment. For Italy, Switzerland, and the Netherlands, so the most of case will pay by lump sum, even for the severe bodily injury case. On the left-hand side, it's mainly periodical payments. Germany and France, that's the two countries which just apply most of the case, they will apply the periodical payments. And for Czech Republic, Finland, Sweden, Poland, and Austria, the reoccurring cost, which means the cost of care and loss of income, they will pay as a periodical payment. For England, there's a PPO, the periodical payment order, has been introduced in 2005. So now we do see a trend. People prefer more on the periodical payments than the lump sum. Okay. By now we have already figured out, okay, for all the Nordic countries, they have they use the model which will have the state involvement, and most of them they will apply lump sum. So the major heads of damage could be quite different compared to the rest of European country. So the next slide, we have shown the composition of the major heads of damage. Here I would like to compare France versus Netherlands. So you can see, because as I mentioned, in France, the motor third party insurance will take all the risk, bear all the cost, and most of them it's periodical payment. But in Netherlands, most of the case it's a lump sum, and there's social insurer who will take care of the severe bodily injury person. So this composite is from the insurance perspective. So in France, 57% of the major heads of damage is the care cost. However, in Netherlands, actually the care cost will be by the social insurer. So from the insurance perspective, the major part is loss of income. Now, after all the basic concept, we start to ask ourselves a question, okay, if the same case has happened in different European countries, what's the difference of the outcome for an average bodily injury compensation? There's a case study. The example is a 30-year-old male victim which has a severely bodily injury, have severe brain damage after road accident, who is permanent disability, married, no children, annual net income is around 60,000 euro. So you can see from the chart, so it's in UK, France, and Germany, the outcome is quite similar, so it's around 5 million or much higher, more than 5 million. So because in these three countries, the runoff period is relatively long, and also they have relatively higher cost of care. If you look at Netherlands and these Nordic countries, as I already mentioned, because of the social insurer who take care of the severe bodily injury person, so from the insurance perspective, the cost is relatively low. And in Eastern Europe, we use Czech Republic as an example. But please keep in mind, even in the Eastern Europe, the countries are quite different. So Czech Republic so far is the only country who has the no pecuniary damage. So which means for the rest of the Eastern European country, the final settlement amount could be much lower than Czech Republic. Now let's have an outlook. So I've already mentioned that's what's going on in Europe. So in the future, which could be a big influence on for Germany, UK, and France, is first thing is the superimposed inflation and the pressure on the discount rate. That's because they have relatively long runoff periods, and also the cost of care is the major part of their cost of the major part of damage. In Central and Eastern Europe, as I already mentioned, even if it's in Eastern Europe, because of the bodily injury damage could be quite different from countries to country, because there's different legal environment. Claims awareness are different, care costs and inflation rate are quite different within the Central and Eastern Europe. In terms of green card claims, I'll leave this to Scott when he talks about the risk of change. For Nordic country and Netherlands, because it's so reliant on the social insurer who will take care of the severe bodily injury person, so that any future change of the legal environment could be a big influence. For Spain, Italy, and Belgium, we do see there's some potential have the future increase of the benefit, because currently there's a big discussion in Spain led by a lawyer, because they find out the motor third-party insurance premium they paid is similar as the neighbor in France. However, the benefit they can get is only one-third of compared to their neighbors. So there's a lot of discussion going on in Spain, so we do foresee there's some change of their regulation. In Italy and Belgium, normally they will use a table that contains the calculation parameters for bodily injury claims. These tables will update every year. So if it has been updated, then we do see the benefit could increase. With all this background information, because of the trend of the demographic and the harmonization of the law and also the social recourses, and more annuity could come for the European country, so we do see there's some risk of change in the future. So please, Scott.
Thanks, Julia. Risk of change. Let me make an introduction according to a study done by Munich Re, I think it was in 2010. And what they said was, and I quote here, "The high level of damages paid out for personal injuries under the US third-party liability system, with serious consequences for the insurance sector and for the industry in general, have been common knowledge for many years. Unlike the situation in the USA, in Europe it was motor third-party liability cover that had become more expensive, particularly where cover was compulsory and highly regulated. And here's a bit. Moreover, this trend was not triggered by a few spectacular court awards, but by a gradual accumulation of insidious factors. The higher compensation claims were paid less often as lump sums and increasingly as annuities." So that leads us through to the risk of change and what it, how it's manifesting and what it means. So let's begin by a definition. Munich Re and other reinsurers may well choose a different definition, so forgive me, but we see it as the risk of unexpected changes in loss factors, social, economic, legal, that take place subsequent to an underwriting decision, resulting in an increase in the severity or frequency of losses, leading to actual losses being systematically and significantly higher than expected. Now, we've posed a number of possible causes here, and we might just pause for a minute and highlight a couple of them. The top left, the change in law or legal environment, and this has been observed through a change in and a movement towards a strict liability regime. For example, back in 1985 in France, the Varinta law, but also in Germany, they've noticed that since 2002, drivers have not been able to rely on what they use an unavoidable event to get out of liability. In fact, the drivers now have to prove a force majeure occurrence, which is proving to be very, very rare indeed. Medical progress in the middle there, a separate study found that the survival rates for tetraplegia are increasing substantially. Some statistics here is that the mortality rate at 24 months post-accident, through a study done in 1973 to 79, found the mortality rates were 29% at the 24-month mark. Equivalent study done in 1990 through 2004 found this is halved to 14%. So we're seeing a much greater survival. In particular, and this is perhaps the insidious factor that previous quote referred to, is that many of the changes apply retroactively. So the changes in discount rates affect all open claims regardless of date of loss. And this is the problem of post-underwriting decisions. So what I'd like to do now is focus on, in the coming slides, on some of the discount rates and other things that are being observed. In 1998, a ruling by the House of Lords saw the discount rate reduced from 5% and ultimately down to 3%. It's currently 2.5%. And this is part of the Ogden tables, which also picks up some mortality assumptions to allow the judges to land on what's the lump sum payment. The graph is decidedly simple, but it does present the, if we start from the current base of 2.5% there, and we project if there are reductions in the discount rates in future, you know, there are potentially, and worst case scenario, up to 34% uplift in claims cost arising from these reductions in discount rates. And in fact, the study that was done found that the change in claims cost through one, I think it was 1998, when they reduced it from 4.5% to 3%, resulted in a 22% increase in that year alone in claims cost. And we'd been hearing from our European brethren about the difficulties faced in writing motor bodily injury reinsurance, and particularly on an excess of loss basis. I'm not sure if anybody in the room attended Ty Burkett's presentation yesterday, but he very clearly outlaid the leverage effect that excess of loss reinsurers have. So we can see that this change in discount rate is significant, particularly when you apply it to the PPO environment. That is, it's not becoming the norm, but it's certainly the take-up rate is increasing. So let's look across some of the countries here that we have. I'm certainly not going to read out individual numbers, but a couple of things I will point out. Netherlands there is posed as 6%. That's actually a nominal rate. That's fixed. But what they're doing is deducting the rate of inflation. It's currently at about a 3% real level. Sweden, whilst 3.5% seemingly okay, it's a nominal figure as well. So it's currently running at about 1.5% real. And in France, that it's about 2%, but it does change yearly, and it's linked to essentially the 10-year government bond rate. What we're seeing is quite low interest rates, and of course, not surprisingly, given the current economic circumstances through Europe. I believe, I haven't updated it, but I believe in Germany it's since reduced to 1.75%. So let's just pause. Let's have a look at a particular case. This is an actual case, and I will allow myself to extrapolate to a broader set of circumstances. So we had a tragic case of a young boy injured severely in 1999. Initial estimate of 4.8 million euro. Now, currently, or at least at 2010, that estimate stands at 11.2. What I want to do is highlight the distinction in that claims movement between factors that are inherent to the condition of the injured boy and factors that are exogenous to the injury suffered. Some data, because I wanted to make sure we looked like we'd done some real analysis here, some data on the cost of care in France has shown over the years observed from 1989 through to 2011, and the database that we've collected in Europe for Munich Re, I forget the number of cases, but I think it's upwards of 1,000 cases above 3 million euro, is showing a clear upwards trend in the cost of care. Regardless of how you fit the line, it's certainly not a good outcome. So in the case in question, what we can see is in 1999, the first establishment of the reserve was 4.8 million. Between 2000 and 2004, not a lot happened. We typically expect at this level that the numbers will bounce around a little bit. And in 2004, the latest advice was 4.9 million euro. Now, it's key to point out here, in 2000, part of the estimate was struck on a presumed care regime, 24 hours care at $10.50 euro or 10.5 euro per hour. When we look to 2006, we start to see a couple of things occurring. One, the discount factor has been reduced from 3.1% to just over 2%. So that uplift there of about 2.7 million euro, I think has been driven entirely by the discount factor. But for argument's sake, let's assume there was a couple of other things going on in there. And I'm prepared, in the absence of other information, so it's 50-50, changing condition and discount rate. But then in 2007, the concept of this new care regime changed. And as a result, the costs changed, resulting in a €2.5 million uplift in the care cost. Our last known position was 11.2. What I would propose is that if we look at the factors exogenous to this poor injured child and his condition, the change overall has been driven as much by these exogenous factors and this risk of change, the things that as reinsurers and insurers we are handed rather than being able to manage ourselves. Julia mentioned the green card. What I present this as is not so much a dramatic position, but just an interesting thing that's certainly unique to Europe. The multilateral agreement was struck where each national insurer's bureau will guarantee settlement of claims occurring in its own in a particular member state's territory, but caused by the use of vehicles normally based in the territory of another member state, whether or not such vehicles are insured, and in accordance with the requirement of its national law on compulsory insurance. So if you are an insurer and you have a view on how many vehicles you're picking up from Lithuania, for example, and how many vehicles you're picking up in Germany, you would reach a pricing view. In such a case, a tourist who drove from Lithuania to Germany, what we've actually seen, the accident occurred in Germany, the person received a claim at about €4 million, whereas all things being equal, that claim was worth about €500,000, solely as a result of its green card system. I think, and I'm not 100% correct, but I was doing some research yesterday, that application where the regime of the state in which the accident occurred doesn't work both ways. There was a case where I think it's been overturned because an English person was injured in Spain and they argued correctly to apply English law rather than Roman law to get the higher benefit amount. So, not surprisingly, it doesn't work to us. So in summary, and bearing in mind the time, what we've tried to do is present a very quick overview. I did say we welcome your feedback on how this should be pitched in future. We've shown you some catastrophic losses that, of course, in Europe, the comprehensive cover includes both property damage and the bodily injury damage. Some of these headline cases of hundreds of millions of dollars, the bodily injury case, whilst a small proportion, can be large in an Australian context. For the European motor bodily injury schemes, the potential outcomes are being influenced by these demographic trends, and in particular, harmonisation of law. And this includes the supranational laws. In other words, the laws that are applying at the EU level across the laws of individual member states. And finishing, in a balanced outcome discussion, what we're trying to suggest is reinsurers are being impacted by this, which means the costs will ultimately be passed back to somewhere. It is not unreasonable to assume they'd be passed back to the insurers and in turn to the schemes themselves. None of us are actually injured, but it is worth noting that things do have a cost. We're trying to present this part of the view as part of that discussion. And for that, thank you for your audience, and I'll dodge your questions now.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Scott and Julia. That was a really interesting presentation. If you do have any questions, can I please ask that you use the microphone in the middle of the room? And we've got about 10 minutes for questions. Got a fair bit of time left.
Paul Rhodes from PwC New Zealand. That was really interesting from my point of view because there's so many parallels to the ACC scheme in New Zealand, particularly looking at the catastrophic injuries. So it benchmarks really closely to it was UK, France and Germany, I think, with mostly annuity payments. And so all of those effects that you've commented on about the costs are fairly similar, and also the changes that have happened in the last 10 or 15 years or something, which is, discount rates and superimposed inflation with just the amount of the costs of care going up a huge amount. So one thing that's kind of been happening recently, which you didn't comment on, though, was the improvement in experience just driven by road safety and better vehicles and stuff. Do you have any data on that?
The strict answer is no. We have no actual data. What I can tell you is the parallels on that issue with Australia. In actuarial word, my favourite word is senescence, and that is when data begins to decay and you can't actually use it because it's too old. We were doing some analysis on catastrophic scenarios, and typically you'd go straight to, in Australia, the bus accidents of 1989 with Grafton and Kempsey. If you look at what's taken place since then, I think there's two key factors which then undermine the ability to use that, particularly in a view on return periods. The introduction of seatbelts on buses in Australia, for one thing, and of course the upgrade of the Pacific Highway switching to a dual carriageway means that you no longer have two buses travelling at 100 kilometres an hour 5 feet from each other. It's equally true of Europe that the road systems will have been updated. So whilst this has been focused on more severity, it's fair to say, it does pose the question about what we could do to get some data about improvements in accident frequency.
Just one more comment regarding this tunnel accident. So as already mentioned, it's in 1999, so this two accidents has happened. So afterwards, when the engineers start to design the tunnel, they do have the improvement of the safety measures, which makes people allows people to escape in time. So afterwards, we haven't seen any tunnel loss. So it could be the improvement of the rail safety.
Yeah, I should add too that Tim Andrews, when peer reviewing this paper, did pose the question back to us about, okay, are there any trends in catastrophic accidents? And the simple answer was no. We're not suggesting there are trends. It was more a case of an observation of what's happened. No more?
Any more questions from the floor? Interesting, Scott, that there's quite a diverse range of systems across Europe and that social insurance does play a part. I'm just wondering, and it's probably a bit outside the scope of your research, but when we're talking about maximising outcomes, I wonder how the compensation and settlements paid for by insurers interacts with the social insurance and whether there's a difference in outcomes and costs because of that.
I think there potentially could be, and this is speculating, so I might have to double check my facts afterwards, but I think one of the key statements that was made in our study was governments across Europe, I think the phrase was, are becoming more focused on providing cover or protection for its citizens where they can't do anything themselves. And the simple example was terrorism and large instances like that. Where they felt that private insurance was in place, I think they were quite happy to let those exposures and those costs be borne by the insurance. It must therefore follow either their ignorance or their belief that won't ultimately come back to some measure of cost being placed back on the citizens, because otherwise why would they allow that? So I don't know if there are regimes where they would limit the actual recourse of insurers back to the insureds through significant rate increases or reductions of benefits, but it's something to be interesting to follow.
I encourage any more questions from the floor. But can I just ask one more then? When you're talking about reductions in discount rates, I mean, clearly it has a couple of effects. One is that the reserves that you have in place for each individual claim is going to change because of the way that actuaries like to put present value numbers in balance sheets, etc. But I was wondering if the true real cost of the claims is changing as a result of discount rates in the periodic payment system. I can certainly see how it does affect if it's a statutory or regulated rate for a lump sum system.
I don't have any data on it about what the discount rate means. There is the point, however, that in the UK the PPOs actually apply a different index they actually apply what's called an ASH index, which is essentially average weekly earnings as far as we would regard it, versus a retail price index. And that difference is something of the order of 2%, I think. So if we go back to that chart where we said, well, what happens if the discount rate were to reduce by 2%? I think off the top of my head it was up to a third uplift. So let's, for the purposes of this audience, call it, you can either increase the indexation factor or reduce the discount factor. Either way, you're going to come up with a similar effect. So the PPOs are, in effect, uplifting by about a third.
Okay, I think that's it. No more questions. Could you please, again, join me in thanking Julia and Scott for an interesting presentation.